morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Is the mic working back there? Okay. So this morning I'm going to talk about case 16 from the Blue Cliff records. A monk said to Kyosei, "I want a peck from the inside. Would you please tap from the outside?" Kyosei is a teacher, the Zen teacher, right? Kyosei said, "Could you attain life or not?" The monk said, "If I could not attain life, I would become a laughingstock." Kyosei said, "You too are a fellow in the weeds." Is that eminently clear? These Blue Cliff records, eminently clear teaching. So, I'll talk about it for a while. We can talk about it. So, first of all, my observation has been over years of doing practice that there are often two phases to practice, to Zen practice. The first phase is kind of the settling in to sitting, to developing a sitting practice. Settling in means that there's more bodily awareness, more awareness of breathing, that you're not just gone all the time when you're sitting, that you're coming back, you're noticing you have a body, and that you can breathe deeply in that body, and some moments of real calmness occur during what I'm calling that first phase. And that's quite, that's wonderful a lot of the time. Sometimes it doesn't happen, and you know, it's kind of boring. But during that first phase, there's generally a settling and an ability just to at least realize that in this moment you can be calm regardless of what's going on. And the radio program is still going, but it's not just dominating things so much that you're not able to have immediate sensory awareness and openness. So, in a way, we feel lighter we can say that all the static in our minds, all of the worrying and concerning, that as that settles, that's actually the fruit of some deeper pain, some deeper sense of separation, some deeper sense of maybe aloneness or dissatisfaction or disconnection. And as that those fruits settle, it's comfortable for a while. But as you get closer to kind of your basic sort of feeling of being cut off as human beings feel, then the comfort all of a sudden kind of is gone, because you're just there with the psychic pain of being human and being cut off and feeling like I'm in here and you're out there and I've got to say something to have some impact on you or make you like me or whatever. And who is this? And what is this? So all of a sudden our practice becomes uncomfortable. And I don't mean just physically uncomfortable. That can happen too, for sure. That happens too. And that's kind of the entrance into phase two. The wonderful, awful entrance into phase two. Now, remember, I just made up these phases. But I've been doing this. I've been hanging out with people for a long time, both as a student and as a teacher. And so, That's kind of a shock when that happens. You think you're settled in, and you're in more psychic pain than you were before, because you're coming up against your basic neurosis of being alive as a human being. So you wonder if you should not do this zazen anymore. Well, you were doing 10 minutes of yoga a day. How about extending it to 50 minutes of yoga a day? Forget the zazen. Or some tai chi and forget the zazen. Or some qigong and forget the zazen. Oh, yeah. And then you may leave. And you may come back. Who knows what will happen. This is a pattern that happens. I don't know if it just happens in our culture, because I only know our culture. But the key here is that when we begin to more fully experience just our basic fundamental suffering, we're really beginning to tap the shell. To tap the shell. As Kyosei was talking about with the student. Before that, we aren't really tapping the shell. The shell that kind of encases us. The shell of fear. Shell of fundamental dissatisfaction about this world, about who we are, what we're trying to do, moment to moment. So when we really begin to experience that and let ourselves experience it without doing anything else, then we are really pecking at the shell. Really pecking at the shell. To use this metaphor. This metaphor from this case record comes from a lot of other stories. All these case records come a lot of other stories about the teacher's role is to tap, and the student's role is to pet. The teacher's on the outside, gently, maybe not so gently, tapping. The student's on the inside, pecking, maybe not so gently pecking. And of course, the shell that's our human fabrication that has some purpose to it, definitely. The shell does give us some security, but it is a very limited, very confined, very constricted security. It's the security that maintains nation states. It's the security that maintains religions. It's the security that maintains families. And it's the security that maintains Tim or Judy or Phyllis or whomever. And it's pretty well fortressed, because it's a scary world out there. So a monk said to Kyosei, "I want a pet from the inside. Would you please tap from the outside?" Kyosei said, "Could you attain life or not?" So here's another one of these non sequiturs that always come up in Zen. I mean, usually you find them immediately. could you attain life or not? What? That's not the question I asked. But really, Kyosei seems to be saying, as far as tapping is concerned, I'm ready. But are you ready to access the energy to attain life? To access that energy to tap and break open your shell and attain this life here? Live this life here. Are you ready to take that risk? And to do that, so tapping that pecking that may not yield any results for a while. Are you willing to do that? Can you take that risk? Do you deeply want to give birth to your Buddha nature, to your still nature, in your life, in your daily life? Is it something that you really care about doing? Regardless of how hard it is, regardless of how much suffering it's going to entail, there's still plenty of time to do Tai Chi. There's still plenty of time to do yoga. There's still plenty of time to do all that stuff. But are you willing to look into this fundamental situation that you're in right now, of feeling not connected in a deep sense to everything? You willing to seriously entertain the notion that you can give birth to a stillness that's been here forever, and it doesn't really need to be given birth to at all, but that you're not accessing, which is completely open, which is completely free? Are you willing to consider that in your very fragile state now, if you're fragile, in your very screwed up state now, if you're screwed up, in your very whatever state now you're in, depressed state, how about that? That there's this energy, there's this life energy that you can draw on. You can draw on this energy. It's always here. We call it Buddha nature. Who gives a shit what we call it? It's always here. Are you willing to entertain that notion? That if you just peck, you just peck, something will happen. As some of you know, I have a daughter who is pregnant, and she's going to give birth maybe the end of May. Could be today, who knows? You know, could be in June, but supposedly the end of May. And this is her third pregnancy. During her first pregnancy, she had incredible morning sickness, and it started really early, and early in her pregnancy, and it lasted a long, long time. I don't remember how long. I'm sure she can tell you exactly how long it lasted. And she wasn't able to keep down food at all. She just, every time she ate, her concern was she going to get enough nutrition in her to be able to bring this baby to full term? But she drew on the energy to keep going. Once she made the commitment, she drew on the energy. And after a while, morning sickness went away, although it was much later than it was supposed to go away. I remember she saying what she thought it was never going to go away. And she gave birth to a child. And as a caring mother duck feels, she loved that child and she wanted to give birth again. But she remembered the suffering that she'd gone through. She thought, I want to do it anyway. Dad, I'm going to do it anyway. And I said, oh, that's cool. Good for you. And she said, even I have to be in bed for 4 months. So, she had her second pregnancy. She had her morning sickness as bad as she did the first time. But she really wanted to give birth to something, a being, bring a being into the world, a being that she could love and nurture. And then something like, I don't know how long into her pregnancy, after she'd been throwing up day after day after day, she went to see the doctor, and the doctor said, this baby is not okay. This baby is not quite dead, but it is very deformed, and it is not okay. and you, this baby will probably not live. I don't think this baby will live. You should abort it. Well, she didn't want to do it. But the doctors all told her, this baby is not even going to live, Aaron. So she aborted that baby. It was quite early term, very early term. But still, she already had 2 months of real suffering. And she rested a little bit. Rested a while. And what did she do? She said, Dad, I want to have another baby. I want to bring life into the world. I love Ethan. I want to bring more life into the world. And I said, do you remember how much you suffered, Aaron? She said, oh, yes. I'm going to take care of everything. So here she is. Here she is. 1 month left. She wasn't as nauseous this time. When I went to see her, she was able to hold down a meal. Just one meal a day, that's all she had to hold down. And when I saw her, I left her 3 weeks ago, she's 5'2". And she's 5'2" this way, too. She is. Well, not really, but she seemed to me. If I see her coming down the corridor, there's not room for both of us. And she so much wants to give birth to life that she takes care of herself. You have to take care of yourselves if you want to give birth to the Buddha who is you. You have to take care of yourself. She has to control her diet. She has to get enough sleep. She has to avoid a lot of stimulation. Because she knew, especially this time, that she really had to do all this stuff. Right in the middle of a very difficult time. Because she wanted to get birth. She did that. And she's this size now. When she walks, I'm very impressed because it's like she's in Kenyan. She walks. It's very, you know what Kenyan, some of you know what Kenyan is. Very, very slowly and deliberately with each step. And she's just going from this end of the room maybe to the other end of the founder hall. One, two, breathing and walking. I think, wow, what zazen. Wow. I just want to go in behind her. Everybody else is rushing around. And there she is, 5'2" in both directions, in all directions. So, pretty good metaphor for me. Pretty good metaphor for this practice that some of you have committed yourselves to. Some of you have committed and then gotten kind of discouraged. Some of you continue with full force when you're discouraged. This practice of giving birth to your natural stillness, your natural joy of being. A monk said to Kyosei, I want to peck from the inside. Would you please tap from the outside? Kyosei said, could you attain life or not? The monk said, if I could not attain life, I would become a laughingstock. This is not a good answer. Not a good answer. He was being open and honest. That's cool, but it's not a good Zen answer. If you give a bad Zen answer and you're with one of those Chinese guys, not so much if you're with me or Hojo-san or Suzuki Roshi, because we want you to be honest and transparent. That's what we care about. But with those guys, they seem to be fairly merciless. And they were mostly guys, right? At least in the stories. If I could not, I would become a laughingstock. Well, he's worried about his image. He's putting all this into his practice. He doesn't want to make people think, I mean, he's a priest. He's given his life to being a priest. He doesn't want to be a laughingstock, so he has to play the role, right? He's got to say the right things. He's got to be the right kind of person. It's not coming from his deep longing. It's not coming from his deep belief that the Buddha is here for him to open up to. The Buddha, which is not Buddha at all, but is just living. It's just enjoying. It's just appreciating each other. But he's concerned with image. And so he doesn't want to be a laughingstock. He doesn't want the other people in the Sangha to think he's not doing it well. So he says, yeah, sure, I'll do it. I won't be a laughingstock. Whatever you say, teacher. And so what does the teacher say? You too are a fellow in the weeds. In the weeds. In the weeds. We spend a lot of our time just in the swamp. Just in the weeds. Just struggling. Just trying to keep our heads above surface to get enough breath to do another day. See ourselves through another project. A number of you heard Reb Anderson when he came here last. It was just last Wednesday. The last Wednesday? A week? Huh? A couple weeks ago. Okay. Yeah. And then he did a retreat at Clouds and Water. And it's wonderful to have a teacher come. We have guest teachers come, right, quite often. And often when they come, after they've come, there's some energy. People feel like, oh, that person is exceptional. And they feel inspired by that energy. And that's good. But don't forget that their energy is your energy. They're not any different than you. They just practiced. They just believed in this meditation practice and gave themselves to it over and over again. They're no different. They're no different. That energy is always here, always present. And it's waiting to blossom. It's waiting to blossom in your life. Waiting to blossom. In my yard, just this last, in my backyard, just this last 5 days, all these blossoms, where do they come from? Well, they come a lot from my wife's hard work, but actually they're kind of mysterious. Where do they come from? Especially in Minnesota, there's nothing here. There's nothing here at all. And then there's a bunch of green. Yeah, there's green in my yard. And then one day I walk into my yard and it's all blossom. All over the place. Where did they come from? It's mysterious. Where does this blossoming of your life come from? It comes from the earth, right? It comes from the earth right here. It comes from taking care of the earth right here. This Buddha body. And this stem and these leaves. The stem and these leaves aren't much. They're not much. Nobody pays much attention to them. But they have a lot of energy coming up. And a blossom will grow when it's ready. A blossom will come out when it's ready. For everybody. Not just for Reb or for Hojo-san or for Suzuki Roshi. It's your blossom. And yours will be different than theirs. Don't compare yourselves to them. This poor guy was comparing himself to other people. Your blossom may be just a little poppy, a little wild poppy. A little wild poppy is beautiful, more beautiful than a rose sometimes, because you don't even notice it. You don't even barely see it, but it's there, blooming. in Berkeley, where I grew, where I spent the first 4 years of my life, little wild poppies always growing. Nobody notices. Everybody wants you to just cultivate big flowers in your garden. But for a 3- and a 4-year-old boy who's very small, we didn't even know. I just saw the little wild poppies. My mother was always trying to cultivate the big flowers. Oh, that was cool. And sometimes something flowers, even if it's a little poppy, a little tiny poppy, a little dandelion. A little dandelion. There's a huge energy coming out. Huge color. And that's why the bees get all excited. That's why the flies get all excited. Everybody gets all excited. Because life is coming up. Life is coming up. So that's the case. That's case 16. And here's the commentary on case 16. The commentaries are given by someone generally 100 to 200 years later. Commentary. Old Buddha had his way of teaching. The monk's answer won no praise. Poor monk. Poor monk. Strangers to each other, hen and chick. Who can peck when the tapping comes? Who can peck? Anybody, any of you, each of you, each of you. Outside, the tap was given. Inside, the chick remained. Once again, the tap was given. Monks throughout the world attempt to name and describe in vain. Shell really is very thin. I know it seems thick. I know it seems like it's made of steel or concrete or brick or I don't know what. But what's it made out of? Thought. Thought. That's what it's made out of. Thought. How thick can thought be? How impenetrable can thought be? Eggshell is like a rice paper screen up in my office right now. There are two of us sharing my office. It's a Zen tradition to have a tiny, tiny space. And you see the tiny space is everything. Rice paper screen. Just a little, how much force does it take to break that rice paper? It doesn't take a lot of force, but our thoughts are so habituated and so strong that we think it takes a lot. It just takes persistent, determined pecking with your meditation process, however you do it, whatever form it takes. And you don't even have to wait for someone to knock from the outside, for someone to tap from the outside. If you deeply trust this process, if you deeply believe in this process, it doesn't matter if I tap in the wrong place. I might have it completely wrong. I may be tapping over on the left side when you need help on the right side. I'm not necessarily very good at tapping. I do my best. But there's a story about Milarepa. Milarepa, the Tibetan yogi Milarepa. And when Milarepa was a student, he had his first teacher who was, it's a guru lineage in Tibet Buddhism, in contrast to Zen. And his first teacher was considered, well, his guru, and he took him on. But the deal with his first teacher was that his first teacher really had not broken through his own shell. And his first teacher was considered a guru because he knew the moves. If you practice around here for long enough, you'll get the moves down, right? You'll learn how to, if you become a priest, learn how to fold and unfold and bow and learn how to look good in Zazen, meditation, learn the stuff that I want you to learn. So you can say, the Heart Sutra said this, the Diamond Sutra said that. You get the moves down, right? Well, that's what most ministers in most religions, and probably Buddhism too, they get the moves down. Well, there's nothing. Sure, get the moves down. Cool. But are the moves just going to be an extension of your shell? Often that's the case. I got more moves. Oh, better shell. It's a bigger shell. Wow. It's still just a shell. Anyway, Milarepa had not. Milarepa's teacher had not, according to this story, right, had not broken through the shell. But Milarepa didn't know this. Milarepa trusted the process, believed that Buddha nature was here, and just kept working, kept sitting, kept meditating, kept praying, kept trying to contain his life. And he had an awakening. The shell just cracked open. And then as a subsidiary benefit of the awakening, he developed a CD, SIDDHI. That meant he had a miraculous power. So he could walk on water. So he walked on water. We don't do that here, you guys. We don't do that. I don't have any miraculous powers. But anyway, so the story goes that Milarepa's teacher was pulled aside by one of the other students and said, Look what's out there on the lake. Milarepa had this great awakening. Teacher, and now he's walking on water. And the teacher looked out, and there was Milarepa walking on the water. And the student said, yes, and I went over to Milarepa in my boat, because I can't walk on water myself. And I said, Milarepa, how wonderful for you. How did you do this? And he said, it's the power of my guru and his name. And then the student said to Milarepa's teacher, will you help us? Will you show us? Well, the teacher thought, well, geez, I guess so. I guess I can do this. So Milarepa's teacher went in the lake and almost drowned. Had to be pulled out by the other students. That's the entire story. That's the entire story. So you don't really even need a teacher. You don't really even need a teacher. Well, maybe you do need a teacher. But not as much as you think you do. Not as much as you think you do. What you need is to tap into this energy that's always here. To believe it's here and tap into it. In your meditation practice, in your life. Dogen, who is our kind of our main man here historically in Soto Zen from the 13th century, he talks a lot about his teacher. His teacher was very important to him. But if you look at Dogen's life and all the years he practiced, he was only really with this guy for a few months. He did practice for years and years and years with teachers whom he thought, oh, well, they're okay. But I want to discover this myself. And then he talks a lot about Ru Jing, but Ru Jing didn't do much, not much happened. Except he did it, Dogen was inspired by it. He was inspired, and that inspiration helped him crack open the shell. And similarly, a teacher sometimes taps a lot, and there's not much pecking going on from the inside. And that's kind of hard for a teacher. A teacher feels kind of sad sometimes. Suzuki Roshi, as you know, left Japan because he was doing tapping, but nobody was pecking. For years and years and years, nobody was really pecking. He said, I want to get out of here. I think there's some chicks in America, some chicks who really want to break free of this prison that we create for ourselves as human beings. So he lucked out. And he was very appreciative, even though we were hippies and beatniks, at least we really wanted to tap from the inside. He had to tell us, how to do it, that it, wasn't smoking joints, it wasn't. And we didn't listen too well for a while. He just kept with it. So, I think that's what I want to say. The shell is very thin, but it's made up of all that stuff. Desire to be loved, desire to be successful, need to be recognized, you need to feel okay about yourself. And that stuff is hard. When that comes up, no wonder you want to leave Zen and go do Tai Chi or yoga or whatever. No wonder. So I think that's what I want to say. Hard, but it's not hard because the membrane is no thicker than rice paper. No thicker than rice paper. Comments, questions? Yeah. That's Katagiri Roshi. Oh, when they were both flying over? Yeah, yeah. Yes, that's right. Did they hear? You mean?
Did they hear the pecking, or were they tapping?
Well, Suzuki Roshi was really saying to Katagiri Roshi, I think there's some people, and Katagiri Roshi very much wanted to teach. If you have a deep longing to manifest the Buddha nature, and then you actually see it blossoming, flowering in your life, you want to share it with other people. You don't care about anything else. So you want to find other people who are going to pack. And in San Francisco, Suzuki Roshi was the head guy. And Katagiri was just a subsidiary, just a young priest. And even though he got older and he got mature, he was still just a young priest. Because Suzuki Roshi was the man. This is the way it works. This is the way life works. So when they were flying over, Suzuki Roshi was saying to Katagiri Roshi, he had people come from the Midwest. He'd read books about the Midwest. These people work in the Midwest because none of us worked in San Francisco. They're working people. And Katagiri Roshi thought, oh. And the idea is if they work, if they do labor, they might really peck. They might not just smoke joints or take trips or, you know, and so Katagiroshi was interested. He was interested. But Suzuki was also saying, you know, there's another part of the country where I'm not huge and you can be. And you can teach, you can tap, and people will be there to peck. And you won't even have to go to rock concerts or sit in a zendo that's full of the scent of you know what. Yeah, Jeff.
Who pecks from the inside? The Buddha.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's right. There's no inside and no outside. There's no inside and no outside. This is a metaphor. The Buddha is always pecking because it's you making your best effort just to be here, just to be here with us in stillness, in openness, finding a little joy that's right here. It's always here. Even if it's a little dandelion, it's here. Inside, outside, all around the town. As long as there's a division between inside and outside, you'll be trying to get out of the shell. But there's no division. But we've created this division, so please peck. Please peck. What else? Oh, okay. So she's saying when someone is pecking, trying to do this meditation practice, how do they avoid falling into the existential yuck, the existential
void,
the existential void? Well, and what does falling into the existential void mean to you? Well, sometimes it's very expansive, and then that's not the existential void. Then that's the void that includes everything. But the reason you have a tapper is to help you when you fall into more of the existential, like, oh, God, this is impossible. That's why you have a tapper, and that's why you have a sangha. We call this Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. These are the three things we used to help us deal with our existential kind of longing when it's at its, when it seems futile, when the practice seems futile. Buddha meaning the teacher and the teaching. Dharma meaning all of the different things that are written that help us. And Sangha meaning each other. We're all in this together. We're doing this together. So, a community, someone to tap from the outside, and books and images from Buddhist iconography to help you, or from your own spiritual iconography. It doesn't have to be Buddhist. Who cares? How's that? Okay.